Anish Chopra.
I like the mood music. That was nice.
Yeah, right. So, Anish, you're the nation's first CTO. This term does not mean what we seem to think it means.
I'm not running an engineering unit?
That's right. Tell us about your job. I mean, what do you actually do as the nation? You must be making the job description up as you go along, kind of. But, how do you decide what to focus on, what kind of projects to tackle? What's your role in the administration?
Well, thanks for the question, and thanks for having me. Tim, I serve as an assistant to the president. There are roughly 25 of us who work very closely to ensure that the president gets the absolute best advice on the policies that we need to take our nation forward. My role is to bring the role of technology and innovation into those policy discussions, as well as to advocate for policy discussions that relate to ways we can improve the nation's technology and innovation ecosystem. So that is the voice that I bring. The unit of output, if you will, is our policy recommendations to the president. And as your friend Tom Khalil mentioned, you could think of us as policy entrepreneurs. We are largely responsible for surfacing new ideas, brokering ideas across agencies where we've got common goals but multiple perspectives on how to get there, as well as responding to requests and concerns by colleagues who would like to understand how technology and innovation can play a role.
So, concrete example?
Well, the levers of influence, if you will, on policymaking are largely threefold. The first is we want to understand the role of data standards, or standards in general, as a mechanism to encourage the kind of policy advice that we're focused on. And I could provide two examples. As we make significant investments in our healthcare IT infrastructure and the nation's energy grid, what's referred to as smart grid, we have as public policy a very thoughtful convening role for government in providing the kind of open platform or standards that should encourage market innovation. And so that would be an example of a policy outcome. How do we ensure that the standards bodies pushing forward on areas of interest are effective? The second policy lever we use...
Before we end this, how do you get public input? One of the things as an outsider coming into Washington I've noticed is that there are a lot of people here who are very interested parties who work very hard at getting their voices heard. And there are a lot of people out there in the heartland or out there on the coast who aren't here, who have strong opinions that may not be the same as the opinions that are being voiced here in D.C. So even when the FCC held open workshops, about broadband policy, over at the FCC headquarters, open to the public, advertised somewhat on the net, the fact is the people who are going to show up there are largely D.C. insiders. How do you get out of the bubble?
This has been a signature initiative for the president from day one. In fact, in his inaugural address, he spoke about a government that works. And in the same sentence referenced the fact that in order to deliver that, we need to operate in the light of day. We have a dramatic change in the way we're approaching public participation. We've piloted it in our own office, that is, in developing the recommendations on how we provide the Open Government Directive, which I'm looking forward to chatting about in a few moments, Tim. We embarked on a journey that hadn't been embarked upon before, and that is... We basically cobbled together three platform capabilities to do our best efforts to make sure that we're hearing the voices from outside of Washington. So we are piloting tools that would help us basically serve as proxy for what historically had been the domain of meetings and folks who have a Washington-centric worldview. In addition to technology platforms to engage in public consultation, part of my job is to get out there. I've had the honor of visiting half a dozen cities around the country and meeting and listening directly with people so that we can have input. In fact, I'll just give you one example. During my trip to Silicon Valley, I'd heard fairly loud and clear that some of our public policy issues in a variety of areas were not really market-oriented or market-innovative. Well, I can just give you as an example. Within 3 weeks of hearing that feedback, I convened with the Deputy Director for the Food and Drug Administration a roundtable of entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and others specifically to flesh out what we can do in public policy with respect to food and drug regulatory frameworks to spur innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an example where, you know, you've got to take this on multiple fronts. You've got to be out there so that you can hear feedback out of Washington. You've got to use tools to gather feedback in new ways.
So if I boil this down, your job is actually a lot like that of a diplomat, an ambassador.
That's an interesting way of describing it. That would be the external side of it.
Yeah.
And then I would say convener might be the internal mm-hmm. description as we look to make the right policy recommendations.
Right. So basically, so understanding what the right policy should be and then influencing those policy decisions within the administration.
Absolutely.
What kind of role do you play with Vivek Kundra, the CIO? I mean, you know, obviously the other big levers the government has around technology are you know, procurement and you know, what does the government itself use internally.
In fact, you'd paused me on the second of my third levers, and the third is in fact that. So if we have influence on standards and we have influence on the second one, research and development investments, we have $150 billion in R&D spend. I work closely with our stakeholders and our research agencies so that we can basically ensure a portfolio approach to the investments that deliver the kind of commercialization potential. The third lever is procurement. Vivek will tell you, we spend $76 billion on information technology. Our purchasing decisions and behaviors have an influence in market outcomes.
Right.
And so ensuring we've got the right framework. Now, the Office of Management and Budget is directed to ensure we have the right effective and efficient policies for government operations.
Right.
And so that is an important role for the federal government, and that's why we have a CIO.
Right. And I look at, you know, a great recent example. I love the GSA cloud solicitation, which really talked about interoperability for the cloud as being a critical component
through procurement
of what they were going to be looking for. You know, this is a way that the government can kind of set the marketplace in the right direction, because it would be very easy to say, oh yeah, we're going to have our own very private cloud and we don't really care about the marketplace, but instead, how are we going to be able to move applications from the government cloud to the out there in the public and so on. We're going to be talking about that with Casey Coleman and Werner Rogels of Amazon later in the program. But I think that's a really good example of how you guys are trying to figure out how to put policy and procurement together.
Yeah, you look at these three levers on any one of a number of topic areas, and you can try to make magic happen.
So I want to come around to the Open Government Directive, because when President Obama came into office, the very first act was to issue really instructions to the CTO to come up with a directive for how the government was going to become more open and transparent. It was supposed to be within 90 days, but you weren't even confirmed until the end of that period. So I think you got kind of an extension. Where are you in that process?
Well, thank you for the setup in that conversation. It was 120 days, Tim. We had 120 days. My Senate confirmation took place on the 120th day. So minutes after I was confirmed. In fact, what he had asked for, and I'm very pleased to celebrate our progress, he had asked for recommendations on how we should issue a directive to the agencies. And my recommendations on that very first day were to engage the public, basically to eat our own dog food. If we're going to embrace the spirit of open and collaborative government, we should adopt those principles in forming the policies themselves. We did that, an unprecedented three-part mm-hmm. process to gather ideas. We had a brainstorming phase. We had a discussion phase where there was a vigorous debate online about where we are on various policy barriers and opportunities for improvement, as well as an opportunity for folks to basically draft in a collaborative manner. We took all of that input, and under Director Orszag's leadership, we've been working through basically a directive drafting process. And I'm pleased to report.
So this is kind of wiki government, where you guys literally took in a lot of input.
We certainly did gather from multiple formats. And what's exciting about it is, Tim, is I'd like to share with you this. We are literally weeks away from issuing the directive, but I'm pleased to report the following key principles of the directive. Okay. The first principle, when we heard from the American people, was there should be a structured approach to this that's not tied to any particular White House. That is, the agencies themselves should have some accountability for the spirit of open government. And in fact, that is our first pillar of this directive. When it will be released, you will see every agency in the federal government will be directed to publish and engage the public in the consultation phase of their open government plans.
Mm-hmm.
Those plans will have several key features. The first of those features, as you alluded to in your opening remarks, will be that we want a structured schedule for how data will be released to the American people in a machine-readable format. We've got the platform.
Bulk data, I'm hoping.
Well, you'll hear different agencies describe it, and you'll engage that different agencies have different
levels of data. But this is a really key point. I mean, if people release, for example, oh, here's our data, here's a bunch of PDFs, that's not very useful.
In machine-readable formats.
Yeah, machine-readable. Okay.
Machine-readable formats. So you'll clearly see that. You'll see that agencies will ask to be reporting on how they will engage the public in policymaking. You ask the question up front. You know, coming to Washington may feel like a barrier for a lot of folks. Well, we're going to be asking agencies to tell you, the American people, how they intend to engage the public in policymaking. And third, we are also provisioning a set of platforms, several of which you're already aware of. You're aware of data.gov. Many of you have seen the IT dashboard. But there are several other platform categories that will be forthcoming. We just announced the use of a challenge platform in a project we'll maybe talk about in a few minutes with the Veterans Administration. So there will be a dialogue around how these emerging platforms can be a tool to enhance the agency. But all of that is really one component, and that is hardwiring our agency accountability for open government. In addition to that...
I like that, the idea. So effectively, this is not something that the new administration will come in and be able to repudiate.
We heard that from the American... go online through the process. We heard loud and clear, you know, it's great that you guys are here and you're doing fun things, but gosh, you know, the administration's changed and what's going to happen next?
So critical to get an installed base of applications out there that...
Hardwire the accountability.
...people will miss if they go away.
That will be a key component of the directive. And for those of you that have been... interested in the directive process, that's the real powerful role that OMB plays, is that they really sustain across administrations the key policy levers. But in addition, we're also putting together a policy working group so that we have a thoughtful way of engaging on barriers as well as opportunities to engage that'll be ongoing and continuous, if you will. All of this speaks to what the president called for on his inaugural speech, and that is a government that works. This is really at the heart of what we're trying to do with open government, and that is if you bring more transparency to the process, you're likely to get a better outcome as a result.
I want to bring out an important point here. I think a lot of people have come to equate this whole idea of Gov2O with transparency, and it seems to me that it's actually about the ability to provide services. When, for example, and some of this is obviously at the state and local level, when, for example, an application reveals when the next bus is coming. You know, that's actually a real service. When is the trash being picked up, you know, as an iPhone app? You know, this is not transparency as in, you know, the media is watching your ass, people in government. This is transparency as in, you know, I'm a citizen and I'm getting real useful data.
Well,
how much are you thinking about? What are the bones, if you like, of the government as an operating system? You know, we have issues around, you know, when I think about Web 2.0, I think about the bones of it are identity, you know, location, you know, events, what's happening. You know, it's really who, what, when, how. And the government has a lot of that data and can play a role along with the private sector in really defining this data-oriented internet operating system that we're all building.
Well, let me answer it slightly in a different way, if you don't mind. I will describe this as sort of light, medium, and heavy.
Okay.
In the heavy space, we have policy priorities. You heard me talk about the energy grid, you heard about the healthcare IT investments, cybersecurity policies and priorities, our education technology area. We are explicitly investing in certain aspects of the nation's economy. And as we look to make those investments, we see great potential in the term you're referencing, government as a platform, that allows us to achieve our goals in a way that wouldn't necessarily be 100% dictated by a government program. And I'll give you an example. One of the areas that we're interested in healthcare is the exchange of information that's with full respect to patient privacy and security. Through the exchange of information, we believe the American people will have greater transparency around what healthcare program and services are meant to treat their conditions that have the highest quality outcomes and to help them make the right decisions. Well, we are setting the foundation by investing in technology, but we've put in place a policy that says when we make investments, the way we will make these investments is whether or not the platform will be utilized. We won't necessarily dictate the mechanisms by which the utilization will happen, but the way we're doing that, Tim, is we're saying to people, physicians who want to buy software, if you will, to help them digitize their practice. They will get an incentive payment from the federal government if they can demonstrate that they're using that technology in a meaningful way.
So you're really talking about this idea that you talked about a lot, which is governing by outcomes rather than, you know, by managing, you know, the process.
We're
or
exactly
so much
what better off
do.
When we do that way.
So in that regard, we have this huge debate going on about healthcare, and yet the government actually already has a lot of healthcare offerings. You know, the VA, Medicare. What needs to be done to make those better? So that it's pretty obvious that the government actually knows how to do a really good job of this stuff.
You know, it's maybe it's an unfortunate circumstance of the times of our day that we don't spend as much time celebrating how we can take advantage of these assets to mm-hmm. further the nation's healthcare system. I'll make one example. Every single veteran who receives a procedure in a cath lab, in one of our 70-plus veterans' cath labs, less than 10 minutes after the procedure, the physician was given a handheld device where they literally draw what they did to the patient. And that, in minutes, is sent not only to the veterans database, but in the spirit of collaboration, a digital version of that is sent to the American College of Cardiology. The association, led by Dr. Jack Lewin, who's really a grouping of the professionals who want to learn about what's working in the industry. That database of cath lab outcomes, 70-plus of which are from the VA alone, probably represents the lion's share of the digitally submitted data yeah. that can be mined by cardiologists all over the country with privacy and
right.
security
so that
provisions.
Really does bring up an important – the government can lead by example, and one of the things we need to do as a group is to find those best practices and celebrate them, whether they're in government or private sector. But going back to this, I know when the data dashboards came out, one of the first things we saw was that the new CIO at VA was sort of kicking butt and taking names and canceling a whole lot of projects, obviously trying to clean
up
the act.
I wouldn't say cancel. I'd say
okay.
on hold.
But clearly, you know, the government is starting to say, hey, we have to show these best practices. You know, how do we get that, you know, to actually influence, you know, the debate in a broader way? I mean, are there things that we should be demonstrating first in the government as laboratory, you know, versus, say, we're going to mandate this for the private sector? You know, lead by example rather than by...
Well, let's perhaps describe that in the area of education.
Yeah.
So we, in the federal government, largely through the Defense Department, although other agencies as well, have been investing heavily in digital learning as a new method yeah. by which we should consider how we get kids educated. There is now a fairly healthy debate around, especially in light of the H1N1 concerns, yeah. what would happen if a school had to shut down for 2 weeks? Or mm-hmm. 3 weeks, God forbid. Secretary Duncan issued a memo that we refer to as the Continuity of Learning Memo that basically challenged the school districts to say, if in fact there is a concern of this nature and magnitude, we instruct you to be as prepared as you possibly can be. And one of the things we'll do to help you in preparation for thinking of this continuity of learning is to bring resources to the table that maybe we've already invested in. We've kicked off over the last several weeks a fairly healthy debate about, yes, there are probably some analog strategies to get kids learning if you have to shut the school down, but there might be some digital opportunities. And here's how the Defense Department's considered it. Here's how other stakeholders have thought about it. And how we're kicking off a new national dialogue, essentially, around what does it mean to have a digital impact on our educational system. So in that example, there might be investments that we've made internally in the federal government to advance our own operational needs. But they have benefit to the broader public, and this is going to be a fun story as the months proceed because we're going to be taking a much more active role in the intersection of technology and education, spurred in part by these government
right.
investments.
Listen, I'm realizing that we are over time. We could probably talk for another half hour quite easily, but we're going to have to move on. Thank you very much.
You're the man. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Thank you.